the 90s, you had grunge and you had hip hop. And the thing that hip hop gave people that no other genre gave was the sense of, I can not only make it in music, I can make it in life and make it in business.
What's up, everybody? Today, I'm sitting here with a very dear friend of mine, as well as the CMO of Visa. Please welcome to the show, Mr. Frank Cooper.
Thank you, Rich. Good to see you, man.
Good to see you. I'm happy we're having this conversation.
It's a long time coming.
It is a long time coming. I was reading up on you. It's always fun to read up on someone that I'm friends with because I get to learn certain things that I didn't know, and I, true to form, learned a lot about you. And it was interesting to me to hear a little bit about your childhood and then think about where you are today. I know how my childhood shaped where I am today, but talk to me a little bit about looking at your role today in life and where you were growing up, how your parents and how where you grew up shaped who you are.
Yeah, man. You know, it's always hard for me to explain it because, I grew up in California. I was born in San Francisco, but my coming of age years were really in L.A. It was in Carson, as Kendrick Lamar would call it, Compton adjacent, right? So like right over the hill. And those were my coming of age years. And so if you had asked me then, could I see myself in this position, running some of the largest brands in the world, now at, the 11th largest company, $500 billion company, I would never have imagined it. It was not even in the scope of what I thought was even possible. And so at the time, I played ball and through high school and, all city, all that, and all state, all that. So I could see that path. But fortunately, my mom had went to UC Berkeley. And she didn't graduate. She spent 2 years there, got married, and it at least opened up that idea that, I actually want to go to Berkeley. And there's some other choices, but I went to Berkeley, and that really changed the course for me. Once I went to Berkeley, I started to see kind of new possibilities. But growing up, this was never, ever. First of all, I didn't even know what marketing was. I had no idea what marketing was. My idea of business was more around technology because that's what my dad did. So anything more entrepreneurial and technological is kind of where my head was.
Oh, wow.
But that wasn't really kind of my core passion, even though I do a lot of that. So it took me a while just to figure out what is even possible out in the world.
So first of all, let me not just like jump over all city, all state, which I didn't know when I was reading. So you played basketball or football?
Basketball.
And you were a real guy.
So I played basketball, but I was at Banning High School. And Coach Ferragamo, they were six-time football champions in a row. We had a big line. At the time, we had the Samoan line, front line. So they were open up wide holes. So you constantly tried to get me to play football. I didn't like that kind of contact. So I stayed with basketball. And, I did well. I played Daryl Strawberry, who's known more as a baseball player, but he was at Crenshaw playing basketball.
And he was a serious basketball player.
Serious basketball player. Yeah. Lefty, strong. He was very strong. Yeah.
So you mentioned your mom went to school for 2 years. So were you the first person to graduate college in your family?
I'm the first one to graduate college from my family. Yeah,
that's amazing.
I have some nephews and nieces that have graduated, but first in my immediate family.
That's amazing.
Then my brother followed after that.
And you went to college with the goal of graduating, or were you already kind of imagining what post-college for you would be like? Or at the beginning, was it just like, let me get this education that's been instilled in me. Let me be the first in my family.
No, well, I always enjoyed learning. So ever since I was really very little, I enjoyed reading, learning, talking to people, just absorbing things. I've always enjoyed music. I played music professionally. I was in, bands and all recorded in studios. So that kind of stuck with me. Those were the two things that stuck with me. But when I first went, I thought I might even play basketball at Berkeley until I went out to practice. And then there was some guy who transferred in from City College. And I think first play, he kind of, head fake crossed over. And next thing I know, I was looking back, he was up at the top of the square. I'd never seen that before. Second one, step back, three-pointer. It was Kevin Johnson.
Oh, wow.
And what triggered it for me is I thought I was good to a certain extent, but that was like another level. And yes. I was like, that is what professional probably looks like. And it's just it was a different level, different, like kind of leap off the ground, different totally. Speed, different, it was just different. And I was like, it became clear to me. And because I love learning, say that, let me focus on that side of it.
Yeah.
And And for me, the more I learned, the more enthusiastic I got about it, the more energy I got. I got great feedback, you know, from teachers and professors along the way. And it became my obsession and passion.
That's cool. It's amazing to hear the story about Kevin Johnson. I have a similar one. It's an interesting story to tell later on in life, but at the moment, it is like very eye-opening. And
yeah.
I had the same thing with Stephon Marbury. It was like the speed in which I saw him go by me on a court made me realize I was done playing basketball forever.
Yeah. It's a messed up feeling at first, though, isn't it?
It is.
Like when you first see it, like, wait a minute. Like, you know, you used to be able to blow past people, and it's just a different level. Yeah.
You know, growing up and being like alive and young and curious in the 90s, I've realized other people like envy. I talked to young people. I went to dinner last week and two people said to me, man, I wish I was a teenager in the 90s. I wish I grew up in the 90s. And I realized that it really is like a badge of honor in some ways because we saw this like emergence of hip hop culture. We saw the globalization of sport, Michael Jordan becoming this icon around the world. But I also think it made certain people start to think that things were possible that were impossible. I didn't have the knack for learning. I didn't find myself focused in school. But that era and seeing some of those personalities like rise to such fame and success so quickly made me think like, man, I can follow this path a bit. For you, you grew up in California during this era too. How much of an impact at this time when you were playing ball, giving ball up, getting educated, starting your journey, were you also looking at like hip hop culture exploding and seeing these stars around the world that you just didn't know before?
Yeah, 100%. I had the good fortune of working at Def Jam. Like, you know, and Def Jam was actually right down the street here at 160 Varick. You know,
right after school? After college?
No. So after college, I worked for a law firm for a year.
Okay.
And then I went into Motown Records. And then out in Los Angeles, earthquake hit in Northridge. We were about a mile from the epicenter. My wife Nina was like, you know, we get the hell out of here. So I thought I was going to come to New York for just a couple of years. Because Russell Simmons and Lior Cohen have been calling me about coming out. And so I said, I'm going to come out now. So I came out for a couple, I thought I'd come out for a couple years and stayed. And I just happened to hit it at the right moment. You know, we had, at that time, it was Montel Jordan. It was Domino. We had Month of the Man with Method Man and Red Man. Signed up Jay-Z. Jay-Z and Foxy Brown did the single together. Got DMX over from Sony. Kanye West came on board. It was a crazy
run. This is mid-90s in New York?
Yes, exactly. And it was insane. And you got to realize in the early part, there's still all the questions about will it last?
Yeah.
But one thing that it did for me was it just reinforced my own entrepreneurial spirit. Because what I saw was that unlike the other, I think, great period in time was 70s, when you had great music and a mixture of things, 80s, to me, it's kind of a dead period in that regard. But the 90s, you had grunge and alternative rock, you had Nirvana and the flannel shirts happening, and you had hip hop. And the thing that hip hop gave people that no other genre gave was the sense of, I can not only make it in music, I can make it in life and make it in business. And I'm going to put it all together.
Yeah.
And there were no stigmas around that. And so we lived in that world. And for me, that was really inspiring. I saw it from Russell's perspective in what he was doing as a kind of business owner. I saw it from the Run DMC perspective, you know, from the management side. But I also saw it from the everyday artists within Def Jam, those who had that mindset of, hey, this is all kind of one thing. I'm performing, I'm creating value, but I'm trying to capture some of that value myself. And it was unique because if an artist would try to be commercial, sell something, is always considered like the sellout.
Yeah.
No one says that word anymore.
Never.
You're talking about sellout. It's like we are here to entertain, fulfill your passion, but to get paid.
Yep, straight up.
Yeah.
And that the sky's the limit.
There are no barriers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It almost became a bit for a lot of people like a new American dream in some ways as a kid growing up in the 90s was that like the idea of making money, building business, and then doing something you love. At the same time, it was like infectious because you're seeing Puff Daddy and Jay-Z and Damon Dash and Death Row and No Limit. And these were these brands that were building these followings like a sports team had.
Yeah. I think that's a perfect phrase, the new American dream, because everyone got the joke. The old American dream had died.
Yep.
Like, what are you going to do? You're going to get one job, stay there for whatever, 30 years, 40 years, whatever, at the end get a watch and a pension.
Yep.
Well, first of all, pensions were over. You know, like they pensions have moved to 401k plans. You're on your own. Yep. People got that joke. The job forever? No. There's mergers, acquisitions, takeovers. No one's giving you any promises. So the first people to get that joke was hip hop culture.
Yeah.
They're like, we're already on the outside of it. You guys are already not building any structures for us, not getting any pathways. So I guess we're going to make our own pathway and do it in a way where we can sustain ourselves long term.
Yep.
I'm not saying it's perfect, by the way, because there's some other underlying things that actually, I think, prevent hip hop overall from being even more successful. But at least gave people a pathway.
Tell me about that.
I think we have a hard time collaborating with each other. It's not enough trust across lines.
I agree with that.
There are opportunities to partner across lines and build things that are even bigger.
Yeah.
And so that doesn't happen enough. I think we don't share enough information. There's always this feeling that, I believe information is power, but most cases, people don't do much with information you give them unless they already got the hustle in them, right? And so if you can share information with each other, it opens up new possibilities. Like if you don't know a deal is about to go down, or you don't know a merger is about to happen, or you don't know that NFTs is on the rise, or you don't know that Wall Street now is putting together large funds to buy music catalog and what that actually means, you got to figure it out yourself. And we can, I think, short circuit a lot of the trauma that happens along the way if we shared more information.
That's a really, it's interesting. I interviewed Terrence Bud Crawford. And right here, this exact table, about maybe 5-6 months ago. And we were talking about, he was building his own business, his promotion business, and he wants to change it. And he talked about how he's hesitant to make certain changes because even though Floyd knows that he was screwed over at times, when he went and built his business, he had to play into the same rules in order for him to make money, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of that is because I feel like these athletes and these entertainers, when they go on to build businesses, are coming from a world in which it's always about ranking who's better. It's always about competition. Then you're asked to have them all of a sudden share secrets and partner and align. It feels against everything that they came up like ingrained in their mind. But I think it can shift because of people like Jay-Z, for instance, right? Because he's separated himself so much from the competition that for him, if you're building a company and you're in basketball or hip hop, you're honored if he wants to take you in and partner with you. But I think as people continue to grow in and you see the Rich Pauls becoming these big brands and Maverick and all these companies being built, as I go into the world now and I meet with young agents and they say, well, who should I talk to? I say, you should talk to Rich. You should talk to Mav. Like it shouldn't be, now that's them. How do I chase that? There's no more chasing. It's like, how does everybody in some ways find ways to collaborate and grow the whole pot?
Grow the whole pie. And the pie is big enough already. And no one necessarily actually even give up any secrets. You're not giving up secrets like, hey, let me tell you about a specific deal. But if you can
There are no secrets.
There are no secrets.
We all know.
We all know, yeah. One. Yeah. But what you can share is like, what's the mindset, that actually allows you to be successful? One thing, and athletes know this very well, excellence requires help.
Yep.
That's the bottom line. You're never going to do it on your own. So if excellence requires help, you need information. You need someone to give you guidance. If you show up, the trick in Hollywood, and this is true for a lot of, I'm going to say black actors in particular, trick in Hollywood is people will respect and reward predictability over talent. So you get someone like Ludacris. Ludacris will be at the meeting an hour early. He will be sitting in the lobby waiting, ready to go, fully prepared, and everyone's going to work with Luda. There's some others that may show up, may not show up, may be prepared, may not be prepared. And the predictability is worth a lot.
Yeah.
And so, but someone's got to tell you that, hey, guess what? You can be the most talented individual. You could be a genius, in fact. But Hollywood is not going to weigh that very heavily if you don't do some of the basic stuff. Yeah. There's an etiquette to this thing.
Yeah, it's a good point. And it's a shame because it's a lot of times the people that know early are the ones that could have given you the break because they know, they spot the talent, right? Like your peers know, the people within the same conversation know, but because of the competition, they wait.
Exactly.
They wait till they see you there. And then you think it's not the time to go partner with them. You did all this because you're now supposed to go partner with the big bank.
That's right.
As opposed to how much power you can get from partnering with each other.
That's right. Yeah.
Let's go to UBO, right? And I don't know how many people ask you about UBO, but the reason why...
Not a lot anymore.
The reason why I'm so interested in that time is because UBO was the model amongst this like five or six hip-hop startups, and I had one at the same exact time. In 1998 and 99, raised a little bit of money to start this company, OneLevel.com, and there was Volume, you remember, and UBO. And, you know, we ran out of all our money in 2 years. I always joke that I sadly spent the majority of it on our launch party, which was incredibly irresponsible. But looking back on it, the lack of education I had, I made up for in those 2 years running that business. It was like I had just gotten my business degree and my law degree.
Yeah.
It was a gift of an opportunity. And I look at that time and realize that at that point on, I started to understand that business, like you said in a quote I read, was meant to improve your life. And I always looked at it as something different. Like the education was to go get the job, and the job was going to be a pain in the ass. And I just wanted to live my life. When in reality, now that all these opportunities were open to us, and you saw this through hip hop and through sport and through that time in the 90s, it dawned on me when I did this company, business is to improve my life, is to make me feel better about myself, to have regard, to have resource, to live a better life. And it started my journey, a long one. For you, you did get an education. You did go and work for two incredible companies. But what did you learn in that startup time in your life with UBO?
That was probably the most critical moment in my entire career. Painful, by the way. Painful because you know the experience. On paper, for a while there, we looked really good, actually, on paper. Like, yeah. How much am I worth? Okay. You know, it was actually a good moment. But and it was a good moment in the sense that, what we were proposing at the time at UBO is that there's this kind of cultural connection among people that transcends traditional demographics. It's not based on age or gender or income or ethnicity. It's based on these kind of shared values and shared heroes and shared stories and shared history. But they were disaggregated. And so having this online presence would allow us to bring people together. That was the concept. And I learned so much about myself through it. You know, we didn't get to the finish line. We even had our ticker symbol ready to go and all that. But we didn't get to the finish line. We sold off pieces of it. We had a crazy launch party, too, at Ellis Island. Crazy. It was ridiculous. Those were the times. But I learned a lot about myself. Yeah. And that's when I actually discovered that what I actually am really good at is seeing how to shape people's behaviors and how to shape their perceptions. And I realized that's what marketing really is. I realized that I could think strategically and creatively. And none of that really came out fully until I went through the UBO experience, because you know this, when you're in that complete startup mode, you're doing every single thing. Yeah. And you'll find out who you are through that, because it's going to be difficult, painful. You're going to push through and you're going to find things that give you energy and things that actually sap your energy. And the things that give you energy, you perk up for that. You know, that's kind of where that's your not only where your passion is, but probably where your talent is. And that's what I learned.
So, it's interesting because after that, I still felt like I was an entrepreneur. And what an entrepreneur meant was that I had to go and build my own thing, or I had to do my own thing. And I think that's a major misconception, and young people fall into that now more than ever. But when I think about your entrepreneurial journey from that point on, from company to company. And I even interviewed David Solomon once, and it was within Goldman Sachs. And I said, to me, that's as entrepreneurial of a journey as one could take, navigating the corporate ladder, the politics that are involved, and for you, different headwinds than he had to deal with in your career. I think about the decision to go from like being the guy, you raised all this money, you had the ticker, and then you went into the corporate world. How was that for you mentally? And do you see that in young people today too, this feeling that like working for a company may not be the entrepreneurial journey that they had set for themselves?
Yeah, look, I mean, I feel like you can create anywhere. And there are going to be some environments where it's much more difficult. The culture inside of a certain company may not allow you to kind of be truly innovative. I've always taken the perspective that wherever I am, I'm going to create, I'm going to innovate, I'm going to try to expand what's possible. And I've been fortunate in that I've gone to companies that have given me that opportunity. But I also learned something. There's two things I learned. Number one is you don't have to build everything from scratch. Probably, that's the hardest thing to do. And we come out of a world where that's kind of what we felt like we had to do.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, because no one's going to give us anything. So you're like, okay, I'm going to build it from scratch and build it up. hardest thing to do. But you can buy things that exist. You can buy things that are undervalued and use that as a foundation to give you momentum and build your idea right on top of that. It's a much easier play, much less risk. I'm seeing more of it now, but I think we can do much more than that. Inside of a company, and you know, some people call it intrapreneurship, there's one thing people, most companies that are successful now realize is that they no longer can rely on their size, their dominance, their current market position. They better grow, they better evolve, and they better innovate. Mm-hmm. That's been the realization. It took a while, right? But when people saw Blockbuster, you know, just like get taken out.
Yeah.
So Tower Records get taken out. See these large companies, their stock price drop 80% because the environment around them has changed so much. Most companies that are surviving and thriving today realize you have to keep evolving and keep innovating. And so for someone like me, that's a blessing because that means that's what entrepreneurs do. You think of what is possible and how can you build it within this environment. But most importantly, who can I get to come along with me?
Yeah.
You know, because you have to get a group of people, a critical mass of people to say, like, I see what you see, or I believe in what you see. And then they help support you to get there.
But how is a young person at a company without a voice of that magnitude who sees some of those deficiencies, how do they speak up within a corporate environment?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, if you need help again, and so what I've tried to do throughout my entire career is find someone who would augment my voice, you know. And so that's number one. Number two, I realized that in many cases the decisions weren't being made in the room where the decisions were supposed to be made. They were getting made far before then. It was like a kabuki play. By the time you got into the room, it was, people went through the motions, but it was already decided. So I realized that the conversations you have outside the room in trying to persuade people and putting them in a position where they're much more comfortable to have the interaction, debate, exchange, collaboration is much more, is a much more successful path. But I was also lucky. Like I had, Clarence Avant was a very, very close friend and mentor to me. And so in many cases, I could go to someone like Clarence. And the beautiful thing about Clarence was that, you know, he would never give you a euphemism, he'd never give you kind of like a kind of a soft angle in. He'll just tell you like right between the eyes, this is what it is. And for me, that was very helpful because then I had no confusion about like, okay, how do I actually convince this leadership team that this is the right way to go? And you know, he would say, hey, it's a person that you need to do, or you need a group of people to kind of align with you, or you need to go to the CFO because that's where the money is, or, you know, or you need to build it outside and show them as possible and bring it back inside. He was very clear, and it was very helpful to me.
Isn't it amazing how incredibly successful and confident people can be so simple and practical, and they know they're right, that they don't have to give you all the color? I've had similar interactions at my time at Roc Nation. I remember talking to Jay about Kevin's free agency.
Yeah.
And he was like, Warriors are the best team and Silicon Valley is where all the money is. And it's like, yeah, I know that. But I thought there was going to be more. And it's like, there's never more. Sometimes it really is just what you think.
The simplicity. I mean, clear as the clouds, right?
Yeah.
Like, but it seems too simple, right?
Yeah.
It's the best path usually.
Because you feel like the simple way can only hold real weight sometimes when you feel like you've like earned the ability to like state the simplicity of it, you know, but it's that frees you a bit because the answer is a lot of times right there in front of you.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, at least for me, I think we get used to the struggle and you think that the struggle is part of the process. And when someone presents something that's really simple and straightforward, doesn't feel like the struggle at all. You're like, that can't be it.
That's exactly it, man.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. You're right. So I think about using that word struggle, the role of a CMO. For me, there's amazing things that I get to learn from building Boardroom. And it was one of the reasons why I did it. I'm full of curiosity, you know, and there's so many blind spots from my early childhood because I didn't go to school. And I always felt like I was trying to get through a struggle, trying to get through the next struggle that I didn't have much time to consume and retain certain things. So like when I read up on your CMO journey, it's like I'm reading up on this for the first time. And it's powerful, even in my age, to learn this information. So I learned about your roles, you know, going from AOL to, let me see if I get this right without looking, AOL, Pepsi. Then you went to BuzzFeed.
Yeah.
Then BlackRock.
Yeah.
Boom. Look at that memory.
You got
that memory. But the role of a CMO is one that historically is for these terms, right? Where you don't stay at these companies for 20, 30, 40 years, or that's how it had been. Why is that? And then for you on this journey, what was your kind of clock, or what was the thing that you said to yourself, hey, I've done my time here and now I look somewhere else?
Well, look, I mean, so the role of CMO, I think, has been a really difficult role in most companies because there's not alignment, particularly in the C-suite, about what should the CMO do? What is even marketing, and what should marketing do? And so historically, you could get away with running great TV ads, great out-of-home, some cool events, and your job is done, right? Because you've probably had some control over manufacturing and some control over distribution, so there are a few players in the marketplace, and all you had to do is remind people who you were. So top of mind awareness, and then you had these marketing channels and distribution channels that allowed you to dominate their mind share. So like, hey, everyone's watching these three channels. Great, we're gonna dominate our ads on that. Yeah. So your job was done. I won't say it's easy because that was still, you know, anyone's watched the whole Mad Men thing. It's still complicated. You got to tell a story and all that. But there was alignment. But then everything changed. It's like, you know what? People don't really want to watch TV ads in the same way. They feel like it's a tax on their experience. Hey, hasn't everything moved to social and digital? So what are you doing in social and digital? And by the way, I can't measure all the stuff that you're talking about. Like now I'm in the world of CFOs where they're like, hey, you know, I want to understand.
Yeah.
Metrics. Like tell me how this is actually driving my business. So I think that's the fundamental flaw, is that there is a lack of alignment between the CEO and CFO and the CMO. My view on it is simple, that the role of the chief marketing officer and marketing in general is to drive profitable growth for the firm by changing people's perceptions and their behaviors. That's what we do.
Wait, say that line again. I like
so
that.
So drive profitable growth for the firm. So we're a commercial engine. It's about making money, driving transactions, growing things. But you do it by changing the way people perceive things and the way they behave, tapping into that. That's what we do. And if you look at it in that broad sense, then you're agnostic. You'll say, okay, can I change someone's perception and behavior by spending all my money on a 30-second TV spot? I can tell you the answer to that is 100% no. Not going to happen on any level. Can I actually generate awareness? Maybe. If I'm in live sports, because people are engaged in that. And so I may spend some money on live sports. But if I look at where people are, where they're interacting, where commerce is increasingly happening, where relationships are being built, you better be in social. Yeah. But when you're in social, every single social platform is like a different country. Different language, different symbols, different evangelists, different ritual, different algorithms. It's a different country. And so it's a new way of actually connecting with people. And I think we're in this transition period where you have some marketers who grew up in that old world and they reminisce about that time and want to be a part of it. You have some who grew up in the new space, but they actually don't have necessarily deep knowledge about how do you build ongoing relationships that drive commercial value. Yeah. And so we're in that transition period, and the best marketers are hybrid. Great storytellers who love data, you know, people who know how to build relationships, but also know how to create excitement and energy. We're in that hybrid period, so it's the most exciting time. And so for me, what I looked at always, for me, and this is partly from the hip-hop ethos, I think, is that I always looked at, first and foremost, am I in an industry that's changing? Now, I wanted to be in a space where things are changing, because if you're in an industry that's changing, everyone's like, we got to do something new and different and innovative. And so they don't go to the tried and true. And then am I with a company that actually wants to lead the change? Sometimes they're a disruptor, like a BuzzFeed. Sometimes they're an incumbent. But they want to lead the change. They're like, we see the need to change and we want to be in the forefront of that. That's always been the criteria. And then my own deep, deep, deep sense of purpose is, if I do what I can do best within this company, Am I in some way expanding people's potential, and particularly communities that have been underserved? Am I expanding what's possible for them in doing what I do? And so I try to get all those three. If all those three things come together, I'm extraordinarily happy. I feel fulfilled. I'm energized. And I think I do great work.
And then is the idea that I'm sure the science that you have to it is different for other CMOs, but for the most part is the idea, though, that when you find that all three of those boxes aren't checked, that maybe at that point it's not the right fit for you or the company?
Both.
Yeah.
Both. Like, I don't think I'd be great in a place where it's like, hey, you know what? You're brand stewards. Just protect the brand. You know, let's move really slowly, deliberately.
You can't operate in that.
Let's follow what happens in the marketplace. We don't really believe that culture drives it. Let's just be right in our category, in our industry, real tight. I would not thrive in that market. I would not be successful. And so if it leans into that direction, or it leans in the direction of we don't want to lead the change, it becomes harder for me because I'm constantly, I'm like you, I'm curious, constantly learning, constantly want to push the envelope, constantly want to innovate and build new things.
Yeah, I get that. That's the entrepreneur in you, even, or the intrapreneur, which I'm going to start using. And I understand that. It's almost like, you know, KD likes to joke around that a lot of the reasons why he switches teams, let me be careful with this one.
Yeah, exactly.
But this feeling that you have as a kid where you're like, your job's done here and you want to take your ball and go somewhere else to play. Now, that probably doesn't relate to every experience he's had. But in general, the idea was always like to constantly challenge myself. I want to go play on a bigger stage with better players in a better system. I want to keep fine tuning my craft. Because while it's about team and it's about legacy and all those things are important, when you put so much work into something, you're constantly challenging yourself. So you're fine tuning your own craft. And I would imagine for you, it's got to be the same way. Like if you feel like you're in autopilot, it's got to drive you crazy.
I think that's so well said. And I think what Katie says is at the heart of what I try to do, which is get better every single day. I'm just trying to get better. And sometimes I get better by reading. Sometimes I get better by watching a movie. Sometimes I get better by talking to different people. Sometimes I get better by repeating things over and over. I'm just constantly trying to get better. As soon as I feel like I'm stagnant, there's a game happening at a different level.
And you're not there.
Yeah, exactly. It's like that's where the A players are.
I gotta get there.
I want to get there. I want to be in that game because it allows you to get better. I think there's only two ways to go. I mean, you're either getting better or you're getting worse.
Yep.
There's no, I'm remaining neutral because everything else is changing around you, right? So if everything else is changing around you, you're either going to get better or you're going to slowly diminish over
without
time.
Without question.
And so I hope that I'm a lifelong learner, and I hope that I'm constantly energized to figure out ways to get better. And I never want to consider myself an expert. Like someone says, oh, you're an expert. I'm not an expert at anything. I approach it with a beginner's mind. Like even if I've been in it a long time, if you don't approach it with a beginner's mind, you think you're an expert. You feel like you know everything. As everything is changing around you, your skill in relation to what is possible in the world will diminish.
Yeah. That's a good point. Well, you're an expert in traditional media, then all of a sudden social came. What are you going to tell everybody?
Exactly right. And then suddenly you're an expert in social, right? You're like, okay, I know Facebook.
Yep.
Then TikTok comes and changes everything.
And you're boxed in. Yep.
Exactly, you're boxed in.
So let's talk about traditional media for a bit, because I sometimes I'm confused on why it still costs so much. Because the hybrid marketers that know that there is room for both, right? I'm pushing a lot of companies we work with to put value back on certain traditional medias because the brand perception or the fostering of that brand, continuing to make sure the brand is seen in a certain way, used to be the one result you could get from some of this traditional media. But I think that there's creativity, obviously, to traditional media, and you should balance it with the impact you can get from reaching bigger audiences and these like sub-communities. But why is it still priced like it was in the 90s? Why is a 30-second commercial and a billboard still priced when we know that the ROI is not what people valued it to be at one point?
Because they can stick us up. That's the only reason. It makes no sense. If you look across the board right now, you see kind of declining audiences, declining engagement, and rising prices. It's either one of two things, right? Either they have... I want to be careful. They have the strength to do it, or you have laziness on the other side. But I do make one massive exception. Live sports is different.
It's different.
That's where you still have simultaneous viewing. You have people interacting. They're online as well as they are on the screen. And so that's the one piece I put into a separate category. But once you get outside of live sports, I don't understand it.
Yeah.
But my hope is this, is that this whole idea of traditional media is changing anyway. So the box on the wall, the screen on the wall is becoming increasingly digital. And so you can start to target people more effectively. And the question I've always asked myself is, how can I move from interrupting people's experience to adding value to their experience? Is there a way for me to do that? And so if you can start to target more effectively and you can produce kind of a much higher volume of content that actually is additive to someone's experience, that to me is nirvana. That's when we've hit something. I'm not saying we're there yet, but that's where I think we can go. But the pricing is just out of whack.
It's out of whack.
Yeah.
When you started a company like Visa and you talked about like the scale of the company, what is a task for someone of your caliber at a company that size when Visa brings you on, knowing all the experiences you've had? How do you approach when you're dealing with a company of that magnitude, when you know that for you, you said, I want to drive profit, I want to keep the brand identity at a certain level? Is a challenge different when a company is that big?
To me, the challenge is really the same. It depends on how long the company's been around and how complicated the business is. And the payments business is very complicated. And so, my approach has always been, first and foremost, come in, understand the history of the company and the industry in which it operates. And so I spent a lot of time early on just understanding the payments category. How do we move from, coins and cash into cards? Like what happened? And before you had the universal credit card, you had these, store company cards and you had gas company cards. But in 1958, they did the drop in Fresno. Suddenly there was for Visa, it was Bank AmeriCard at the time. Suddenly you had a card where you can use at a bunch of different places. And that was fascinating in and of itself. But then I realized that it did something else. Before that time, if you wanted any kind of personal loan, you actually had to go into a bank and they would send you downstairs into the basement. And you would sit across the table from someone and they would decide whether or not you're worthy of a loan. What this card did is it said you can pay it all back within 30 days, but it basically gave you a personal loan without having to go into the bank and have the person across you from you judge you in terms of whether you can get a loan. And so it opened up that whole aperture. So for me, though, learning the history, what the logic of what was done throughout time, that's kind of the first thing. And the second thing I do, I spend a lot of time trying to understand the economics of the business. Like, how is money made? And then the third thing I try to get my arms wrapped around is, where's it all going? Like, who's nipping at it? Why are people, what are the, in our case, fintech companies, what's happening with that? Or what's the next generation of consumers? What are they interested in? How are they behaving? And so if I get those three things, that gets me a large way there. The other side of it, though, is relationships. Because, people think of these companies, these big companies, as, this massive, faceless entity.
Yeah.
But it's people inside that are actually making things happen. And if you have good relationships and you have trust, that's how things get done. And so it's a combination of kind of having that understanding, historical understanding and the economic understanding, but also building relationships of trust where people are willing to kind of go out on the limb with you.
And the relationships and trust internally as a marketer, does it have an effect on the ultimate product and the result of the product? So if you have the chemistry and the culture intact internally from a marketing standpoint, the brand ultimately becomes more sellable. The brand ultimately becomes more attractive just because of the spirit exuding out of this company, no matter how big they are. Do you feel like that has a real impact?
It does, because, I mean, and you know this, like, great ideas are fragile,
yeah,
especially in the early stages. And so if you have people who are skeptical, don't trust you, and don't let you take even that half step, and they're chipping away at it, by the time the idea is finished, it actually has no impact whatsoever. So having people trust you early on, I think, is critical to having great product at the end. But the way I think about trust is not just some like abstract idea like, hey, do I trust you or not? I think people are asking three things when they say, I trust you. Do you understand me? Empathy. Are you capable? Do you have the skills? And then do you have integrity? Do your words match your actions? If you got those three things, people tend to trust you. But you have to have all three. Yeah. Like you can really care about somebody but have no skills at all, being like, that's worthless to me. You know what I mean? You could have the skills, but don't care about anyone. They're like, well, you're out for yourself. You need all three to make it work.
The integrity and pride thing is big. That's something that I feel like, I wouldn't say young people are challenged by or compromised by, but I think that it's not as much of a driving force behind young people today as it is for our generation. There was a pride about holding a job. There was a pride about the way in which you did things. Do you think that that's just a reflection of like the world today, or do you not even notice it?
No, I notice it. I notice it, but I don't know the answer to it. I think part of the answer is that today, a specific job doesn't define a person as much as it used to. Yeah. And so people are basically saying, "Hey, I'm an entrepreneur, so I am the brand, I am the job." Yeah. You know, or if I'm in a job, it's still me moving to different places, but I want you to recognize me and my transferable skills. And less people are saying, this job, I am, you know, an employee at this particular company. I'm here forever. I love the association. I take pride in it. It's less and less of that. In my opinion, in order for that to happen, there has to be a greater mutuality where large companies, any company actually, are willing to make sacrifices on behalf of the employee. And that's a hard thing to do in this environment. That's the only way it will change, because then it's like, okay, we are in this together to a larger extent.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point.
You know, and they're willing to dig in. It's like, hey, guess what? We didn't have a great year. You know, people at the top may not take as big of a bonus, but we're going to make sure we take care of our people. That changes things.
Yeah.
You know? And you see that at some companies. I think we need to see more companies have a greater sense of that mutuality.
Yeah, that's a good point. The last thing you need are an older generation just complaining about a younger generation, right?
right.
That's just not going to benefit anybody.
Yeah.
Last thing I want to talk about is talent. As a CMO, you've been around Pepsi and their big Super Bowl activations. Obviously, you were a part of one of their biggest deals ever. I know you did the same thing with X Factor. Talent used to be picked out of like this small group of people, right? Like you could say, you know, I have the money for one of the biggest artists in the world. Then you'd go, okay, are we talking to Beyonce? Are we talking to Rihanna? Are we talking to Madonna? Who it was?
Yeah.
And in sports, it was the same thing.
Yeah.
Now you have to really challenge yourself to think about who you're trying to reach and what it is that you're trying to get out of it. Because some of the talent today can have a massive audience with no engagement, can have no real influence on people. And some of the people that have real influence can be coming from these smaller gaming communities, can be coming from certain sectors, certain sports. And it seems like you've always understood that. You've always had a knack for engaging in the gaming community and sports and music. I think for a period of the last 10 years, NBA culture felt like it was the most influential. Before that was hip hop culture for sure.
Yeah.
And now it's saturated a bit. I think NBA and hip hop still drive a lot of that influence. But there's people that are building companies that are billion-dollar companies now that were influencers.
Yeah.
So how do you juggle that and think about like timeless talent that you want around your brand, and then looking at these creators with these big platforms and these big numbers now for what they can bring to your company?
So I think we're in a moment in time where the idea of having a celebrity endorse your product and get your and the brand getting a halo effect from that is minimal. I think it's, for the most part, a waste of time. Like, I wouldn't, like, even when I was at Pepsi, if you're like, okay, you think someone's going to believe that if I have Beyonce do a drink shot, that they should drink more Pepsi? Yeah. I'm like,
We know too much.
Like, they may ask, how much did you pay her? You know, and so even with the Beyonce, biggest star in the world, and even with her, I said, let's not do that. Let's figure out, like, what do you want to do that you cannot do within the current constraints of the industry that you're in? You want to do a documentary? You want to release a song in a non-traditional way? Should we do a movie together? So for me, the logic I'm using now, and that I've used for quite some time now, is not so much to get a celebrity or an influencer to kind of rub shoulders with the brand. It's to help each other move forward. And so I try to figure out, how can I help this artist move forward? And now to do that, you have to look at the industry differently. You have to understand the other industry. So like, if you're in video gaming, like, so what's happening in video gaming that is problematic? Well, game developers don't have the same kind of platform they used to have, and the same kind of tools and ability to build, and same outlets. Maybe we should be in the game developer world and Exola and partner with them. You know, or from in music, it's not just emerging artists. It's artist's ability to kind of do non-traditional things. Maybe a big artist doesn't want to do a stadium. Maybe they actually want to go to a special location and do an intimate performance that's never been done before. We can fund those kinds of experiences. Maybe they want to be an entrepreneur and they want to go into technology. And so the way I see the brand's role is to, especially Visa, and you know, the way we're positioning our brand, is to help people move forward. And that is true of everyday people, but it's also true of celebrities and influencers. No matter how big they are, and you know this really well,
yeah.
No matter how big you become, there's always some constraint, some wall, some box someone has put you in to say, okay, this is where you live. You can't do that.
Yeah.
And that artist, that performer, that athlete may want to do that. That's where I think we come in. The brand is playing at the margins of helping people move forward.
That's an amazing point, because there's like a secret that they all hold. It's something else they want to do.
100%.
Something else they feel a bit embarrassed to say out loud. And it takes someone that knows how to manage talent, and you know how to manage talent, to push that from them and push that out of them. And then all of a sudden the brand wins.
That's exactly right. Yep. Exactly right. And they win.
And they win.
And it doesn't even matter how successful the actual outcome is. You put them in the game and you gave them every opportunity to succeed. That changes people's perception of who you are as a brand and as an executive.
And the last question for me on the marketing side, the physical, the experiences. It felt like, especially during the pandemic, we had lost complete understanding of how important it was to be around people and to experience moments, and then what the ripple effect was from that. And obviously you trusted in us to create a small event in New York City. And I believe that it's those small events, it's those moments that people can actually recall that end up having more of a lasting impact. Have you started to see that shift for you guys as a company and in the market in general about how important the physical moments are again?
Yeah. So first, I'm a big believer in virtual environments. I think it's going to be a fantastic thing. I think it's going to continue to grow. It will be a universe onto itself. But there's nothing that replaces physical proximity. And maybe one day in the evolution of human beings, there will be. But right now, there's nothing. Like, you can't feel the energy of a person on the screen.
No.
I can feel your energy right here. We're sitting right across from each other. We interact in a way that's very different. We feed off of each other in that way. You ask any performer, what are their best performances? It's when the audience is giving them energy. It's this physical proximity, I think, that's really important. And that's why I actually loved what we did in the boardroom talks, because it was the environment that it was at the Roxy, so the environment was right. Yeah. You had the right people there, Michael Rubin and Lil Baby. Yeah. The conversation was substantive, right? We were really, it wasn't just like, hey, let's hang out. It was a substantive conversation. And then people kind of engaged in that conversation. You can't, at least right now, replicate that. And so for me, I'm a big believer in physical proximity, live in-person events, but designing it in a way that actually allows for real interaction.
Yeah.
Where things go wrong is, and this is true, I think, of people coming back to the office, is when you just say, like, hey, just be here. And there's no design experience, no outcome that is expected, no interaction, no reason, reason for us to be connected to each other. But I'm very excited about the future of live events, proximity, and intimacy. So I'm really like on this smaller is better thing right now, so that people can really interact.
Plays so well into the digital behavior too of FOMO. Straight up.
It does.
Like, yeah.
It does. Like if you open it up too wide, I was there too.
Yeah. You're 100% right though on, having to tell people why, because like we said earlier, they know too much, and that's the, the divide with young people is if you don't meet them and say, hey, I need you here for this reason, you can no longer tell someone to just be here.
That's right. Because
they already know that that's not the answer.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, Frank, as I imagined it would be, I've learned a lot, my friend. Thank you very much. It's an amazing point in your career and your life, too, because you still are so much in touch, in the mix. You're kind of in that hybrid time where you understand the old, you understand the new, and I'm excited to see what's next for you.
I'm excited, period, man. And I always love talking to you, Rich, man. It's always a great conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you, man. Thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing, tuning in. Frank Cooper, Visa Boardroom. See you all soon.